This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Growing up in northern Kentucky, my father only drank Wiedemann beer. Going to the movies meant going to the Liberty Theater in Covington. I took a prom date to the Lookout House before it burned to the ground. And as a reporter, I covered the 1980 fire that destroyed St. Aloysius Church in Covington. But those are just a few of the institutions that shaped me and lots of northern Kentuckians in the 19th and 20th centuries that are highlighted in a book entitled Lost Northern Kentucky. We are joined today by the co-author of that book, David Schroeder, who is also the executive director of the Kenton County Public Library. To join the conversation, please call us at 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. Dave, welcome back to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you, Dan. Always pleased to be here.
I think the last time you and I were here talking about the lagoon, the Ludlow Lagoon, or whatever, Ludlow Lagoon and a bunch of other places.
Correct.
So it is summertime.
Yes.
So I thought it would be fun to start. I don't want to go back to the lagoon discussion, but I want to start with some of the recreation areas that you focus on in this book. These are all of this, what you're focusing on are sites, buildings, structures that have disappeared.
Correct.
So one of the things that sort of relates to summertime recreation, Latonya Racetrack.
Absolutely. Latonya really was a mainstay in northern Kentucky for decades. It was the racetrack, really, in greater Cincinnati and had a huge impact on the development not only of Latonya but of northern Kentucky as well.
And one of the things you point out is that extending the streetcar to Latonya Racetrack meant that Cincinnatians really had easy access.
Absolutely. The streetcar company actually is mentioned various times throughout the book because the streetcar companies were really looking for people to ride the streetcars on weekends or on evenings. You know, they were getting
off
people
hours.
Back. Yes, they were getting people back and forth to work, but they were looking for places to take people, you know, when work was done. And so at the end of the line, so to speak, on almost all of their lines, there was an attraction, the lagoon being one. Latonya was a huge one at the end of the Latonya streetcar line.
So one of the things about Latonya that you mention is that it truly was a rival to Churchill Downs for
Absolutely.
A significant period of time
Yes.
and the races it developed.
Absolutely. The Latonya Derby at one point was actually larger than the Kentucky Derby, which we find hard to believe. You know, it was drawing
Remember,
larger crowds.
Remember, this could be heard in Louisville
well, it
if
could.
People online.
Yes. This is true. They had bigger purses at a time. They kind of pioneered the $2 bet at Latonya, which I think is very interesting.
They talked about that a little bit. That,
yes.
That's one I had never heard before.
Yes. You know, betting wasn't a standard kind of thing in the late 1800s and early 1900s, and the owners of the track came up with a plan to do a standard $2 bet, and it worked, and it was copied across the country. And so that, you know, that $2 bet we still put down today when we go to the track, you know, goes back to the Latonya Racetrack, wherever you are.
So Latonya, just so to make sure people know, Latonya is a part of Covington.
Correct.
Sort of on the south part of Covington.
Correct. It was a city unto itself for many years, and it had expanded very quickly, spent a lot of money that it didn't have, and eventually had to go to Covington and ask to be annexed. It was very controversial at the time. In 1909, Covington decided to annex the property. And so the city of Latonya became a neighborhood in Covington. But it still has a very strong identity. And there are still many people in Latonya that still address their mail as being not from Covington but from Latonya. So Latonya still captures the spirit of a city, even though it's a neighborhood to this day.
My father's family was for a long time
Yes.
in Latonya.
Yes.
Yes, I got a feeling of that.
Yes.
Queen City, the beaches.
Yes.
This is people, if you told people today that there were major, significant beaches along the Ohio River that people flock to in the summer, they just shake their head.
Yes.
What are we talking about here?
Particularly in Campbell County and the cities of Bellevue and Dayton, we had the Queen City Beach, we had Tacoma Park, But these were actual recreational facilities. The Queen City Beach, for instance, in Bellevue, had a facility that was three or four blocks long along the riverfront. It had changing rooms. It had concession stands, you know, everything that you would need to go bathing. But the interesting part about it, I think, is that, you know, people actually swam in the Ohio River.
What time period are we talking?
This started in the late 1800s and continued well into the 1920s. So it was a long period of time. And when you think about it, you know, we're living in the summer here in Cincinnati. We had that long stretch not too long ago of, you know, 90-degree weather. You know, we're accustomed to going in the air conditioning. There was no such thing in those days. And so people were looking for places to cool off. Swimming was an obvious choice. The river was there, and they used it.
Clearly not total sensitivity to the quality of the water.
Correct. and there are, in the newspapers and other accounts, there's discussion about that, you know, people are bathing in water that was not necessarily freshest water that you would want to bathe in. Certainly wouldn't be water that you would drink, but people didn't have the compunction about, you know, not swimming in it. They used it for recreational purposes.
The Ohio River was also referred to at times as a chemical river.
Oh, absolutely.
Things had gotten really bad.
Yeah, they had. And, you know, we had major industries in the area that were still dumping things into the water at that time, and it was perfectly legal to do so. And then people were bathing in it at the same time.
One of the things to make clear here that these beaches, which are hard to even imagine today, it's because of the permanent high-lift dams that we have.
Correct.
That have sunk those beaches.
Absolutely.
But historically, that Ohio River rode much lower, especially in the summer.
In the summer, the river was very low. And so you had natural beaches that developed, and then the owners of the beaches would bring in sand as well to kind of, you know, augment what was going on and make it more Florida-like. In the 1920s, you know, it was a big move to go to Florida for vacation, and, you know, Florida was the happening place. And so, you know, making the beaches more like the Caribbean, like Florida, was something that they were doing.
You know, I can just see the advertising. Save the money. Don't go to Florida.
Absolutely.
Don't go to Jamaica. Just go to Bellevue.
Queen City Beach. Yes, just, absolutely.
You know, somewhat related to that is the fact that the Newport Barracks started right down where the Licking and the Ohio came together.
Yes.
And not because of that low water, but because of high water.
Right.
Then it gets driven and reorganized very differently.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about the Newport Barracks, but then let's talk about Fort Thomas.
Yes. The barracks were, a major Western military encampment. You know, they were at the point, across the point, points in Covington, so it was across the Licking in Newport. And it was basically, a key hub of protecting the Western frontier. And, we don't think of ourselves as being the Western frontier, but at one time we were. And so those barracks played an important part in protecting Cincinnati and the development that was happening in the region. But as we talked about, the river fluctuated throughout the year. You know, it went up and it went down, and, you know, you had major floods. And eventually, you know, the location of the barracks just didn't, you know, it just wasn't working any longer.
Well, there were two really terrible floods,
correct.
1883, 1884.
And the following year, correct. 1883 and 1884 were massive floods that usually don't get a lot of attention because they're overshadowed by 1913 and then, of course, 1937. But the 1883-84 floods were truly devastating to the greater Cincinnati area, and it really was the death knell for the barracks. It pretty much destroyed what was left. And the U.S. government decided that it was better to move the fort to higher ground.
The really issue, the issue, as I understand it, was even whether to have a military,
yes,
presence in this part of the country by the time you hit the mid-1880s.
Yes. I mean,
we were no longer the frontier.
Correct.
You know, but the decision ended up being we're going to go and rebuild this and build,
yes,
it up on the heights.
Yes, and some of that was due primarily to politics. You know, we had some...
Oh, really?
We had some, you know, high-powered legislators in the greater Cincinnati area who wanted that military encampment still in the greater Cincinnati area. And so they lobbied and did so successfully to make sure that the fort didn't go away. It just got moved to higher ground. And that's how Fort Thomas really evolved.
And when we're talking about Fort Thomas, because people can still go there, there are still elements of Fort Thomas that are there, significant elements in some cases.
Yes.
You can really understand what they were trying to do and how, why they were building on that particular plot.
Basically, it was a little city they were building. You know, they had a barracks building. They had recreational facilities. There was a chapel on the site that was used by Protestants and Catholics. And so it was kind of a multi-denominational building. There are the officers' barracks, which are right now being, you know, discussed and being restored. And so those are beautiful homes. Sitting on the brow of the river with wonderful views.
What's your understanding about where that stands at this moment? Because those are incredible structures.
Yes. I think something is eventually going to happen there. You know, funding is always the key element. You know, it's trying to get funding to make sure, you know, the houses have sat vacant for many years. Mm-hmm. And the one of the worst things that you can do to an older building is to leave it, you know, vacant, because the upkeep falls off. And as we know, with any old structure, if you're not keeping it up, it's falling apart. And so if we had done this maybe 20, 25 years ago, we'd have been in much better shape. But, you know.
And we were talking about doing it 20 or 25 years ago.
Yes.
I've done all kinds of stories on Fort Thomas.
Yes.
And Fort Thomas really functions through World War I and
absolutely.
Into and through World War II as well.
Yes. My grandfather, who was in World War I, was inducted at Fort Thomas. So, mm-hmm. you know, and that was 1918, I believe, when he was inducted into the military. So, and I can remember military parades when, you know, when I was a child, where troops from Fort Thomas were in the parade. You know, it's part of our living. Yeah, it's part of our living history. Our living memory, I should say.
One of the things that you talk about first in the book, its very first essay that you write, is about the Wiedemann Brewery. And I mentioned at the beginning that Wiedemann was the only beer in our house. And my father didn't buy it at a store. I can still remember this. His business was in downtown Covington, and we would go into an alley, and he would go into the back of a saloon and come out with a case of Wiedemann. You know, that's how he bought his beer.
Yes.
And my understanding is the label has been bought and is going to get reestablished. But, oh, my gosh, in St. Bernard, Ohio.
Correct.
Not in Newport.
And there's a little bit of angst over that in the area. You know, it was such a part of Northern Kentucky, particularly Newport. I think people who haven't lived here as long or, you know, are younger don't remember how massive that plant was in downtown Newport. You know, it was several blocks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was a magnificent structure. There was a rooftop garden, beer garden that was attached to it, where you could go and have a meal. And it had a wonderful view of downtown Cincinnati.
So whereabouts in Newport was it?
It was, if people are familiar with where the old Remke's was, that's probably the easiest way to think about it. It was kind of in the heart of downtown Newport. The Remke's is still sitting there. The building is still sitting there. It's vacant. And the parking lot in front of it, that whole area that takes up that complex used to be the Wiedemann Brewery. And it was a huge plant. It had not only a regional market, but it also had it was getting close to having at least a partial national market. It never quite got there, and that was probably the reason why it didn't survive.
Well, that's really the issue for all Cincinnati breweries.
Correct.
That they did so well with the local market. They weren't pushed into national marketing.
They didn't have to.
And that bit them on the other end.
Yes. I think I was reading somewhere where Bavarian and Wiedemann were selling about 70% of their stock in the area. So, you know, transportation was not an issue. You know, they weren't having to send, you know, things long distances. And so much of the beer that was produced in Greater Cincinnati was consumed in Greater Cincinnati. And, you know, our high German population in this area resulted in a very high consumption of beer.
The Irish did their part, too.
They did. They certainly did.
Let's just be clear about
that. This is true.
So a couple of places that are relatively famous that you spotlight here are the Lookout House.
Correct.
And the Beverly Hills Supper Club.
Yes.
So both of these end very badly, obviously, the Beverly Hills tragically.
Yes.
But what can you tell us about each of these places?
I think it's interesting in that how they developed. You know, I think it goes back to the Prohibition era and back even further than that to a certain extent. But, you know, we had a culture in Northern Kentucky of alcohol consumption. Gambling in Northern Kentucky was seen very differently than it was in the rest of Kentucky. You know, we had a much more Midwestern sensibility about those kinds of issues. Religion played a certain part in that. Ethnicity played a certain part in that, you know. And so the development of those establishments, although technically were illegal, were just pretty much ignored. My master's thesis when I was at UC getting my master's degree in history was called the Oasis of the South. And it was a term that one of the prohibition agents used to describe Northern Kentucky. It was the Oasis of the South. Hmm. Because you could go anywhere and openly buy alcohol. And so to a certain extent, by making those things illegal and prohibiting them, it drove them underground and it made them a very interesting aspect for the mafia, for the mob. And so Northern Kentucky becomes this battleground between the Cleveland and the Chicago Syndicate. And so, you know, the Lookout House, Beverly Hills, got pulled into that, you know, mix and was developed in many ways because of that. And, you know, Prohibition in general had a huge impact on our region that most people don't understand.
Well, Cleveland Syndicate was really using Northern Kentucky as a test market before it—
Absolutely.
As it was moving on to Las Vegas.
Correct.
And developing Las Vegas.
And there are stories
stories.
Well, yeah. In the 1920s I think there were somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 to 30 deaths in Newport or outside of Newport during this battle between the two mobs where people were just found in their cars with 30 or 40 bullet holes in them. And nobody saw anything. You know, it was just— And, you know, it was making front page, you know, news, and there was lots of editorials about it. But for the most part, you know, people knew who was being killed. People knew why they were being killed. And if you kept your nose clean, you just kind of ignored it.
Well, you, in your introduction, you say that in a book like this, there's always going to be things that you can't include.
Yes.
And one of the questions I had after reading about the Lookout House and the Beverly Hills Supper Club— well, Lookout House particularly. Why didn't you include something about the restaurants on the Dixie Highway Strip?
We discussed that. Deborah Cole Kramer had come out with a wonderful book on the Dixie Highway, and she covered that so well. So we tried not to duplicate that because it had already been done. So we were looking at things that, you know, hadn't got as much attention. So we kind of, you know, moved on to some other topics that maybe— needed a little more coverage.
Okay. Well, one of the things you talk about that I suspect that people wouldn't know in terms of its original name was St. Walburg Academy in downtown Covington.
I think of all the places in the book, to me, that is one of the greatest losses is that entire block. Mm-hmm. It's East 12th Street between Scott and Greenup. And it was basically the entire block.
Close to the cathedral.
Yes. It's actually right behind the cathedral.
Right.
St. Joe's was the German parish. The cathedral was the Irish parish. So, you know, there's stones thrown from one another.
Are you saying stones got thrown?
Probably, yes. Yes. The cathedral is older, but it was not in that location originally. It was on 5th Street and then on 8th Street. So St. Joe's had been there since the 1850s. It was the anchor German parish on the east side. next door to it was the parish school. Next door to it was St. Walburg Monastery, which was the mother house of the Sisters of St. Benedict, who are still in Northern Kentucky. Next door to that was St. Walburg Academy, which was their downtown academy for young women. Next door to it was St. Joseph Elementary School. So that whole block at one time that is now pretty much vacant was full of these beautiful historic buildings, many of them that were built right after the Civil War. Behind that property, behind the church and the monastery, was the Covington Art Institute, which was a Catholic art institute that trained young artists to build pulpits and altars and do paintings for churches and cabinetry for organs. Johann Schmidt, who's best known for his work at Immaculata in Cincinnati, Mount Adams, and at Mother of God in Covington, his work, he was one of the main teachers at the Art Institute, and he taught young Frank Duveneck there. So Duveneck got his start there as well.
Well, David Schroeder, co-author with Robert Schrage of Lost Northern Kentucky, we've only touched the surface of what you've written. Where can people find this book?
It's at all local bookstores. You can, of course, get it online. I would be a really bad librarian if I didn't say you couldn't go to your local library and check it out there. There's plenty of copies at the Kenton County Library. So there's lots of opportunities to find the book.
And just to quote something that you quote in your introduction, a land without ruins is a land without memories. A land without memories is a land without history.
Absolutely.
Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. Segment producer is Layla Shakui. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley. Stay tuned for Here and Now on 91.7 WVXU. Hamilton County sales tax hike? Never mind. Under threat of a lawsuit, county commissioners put an end to the increase. Plus, time is running out for the 3rd Street Homeless Camp, and unanswered questions about a future music venue for the banks have business owners feeling restless. And more changes coming to local TV news operations. We'll look at this week's top stories Friday on Cincinnati Edition at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.